everybody shortens that passage from 2 Chronicles. They say, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray, I will heal their land. If they lift up a critical fight, if they turn from their wicked ways. And at the moment, this country is wicked.
Yeah.
So to say. It's my country, it's born here, raised here, I've traveled the world, but I always come back. And I hear quite a few American accents, and I see quite a few African-American people. Welcome home. Sorry we made such a mess of the place while you were away. Are there any cause of people here? Cause, though. Are there? Then you will understand, lady, what that name means. It's called Bulala. You know what that means. It's a beauty. So it kind of overlaps a couple of the African tribes, and Zulu and Xhosa are allied in the linguistics, and it means destroy or kill or execute or slay. So quite a provocative word, but I'll tell you why I use it as the title of the book. But the doctor mentioned witchcraft, sacrifice, etc. We've had a furore in Cape Town a week or so ago, you probably saw it, where a sheep was dragged down to the beach, dragged into the sea, and cruelly slaughtered in front of everyone, in front of the kids. The sand was white sand, beautiful, pristine white sand, was red with blood. It was an absolute farce, an absolute stunt, and it was an insult to the traditions of our people, because it broke just about every rule. But either way, it's not over. Today I picked up on the internet that local evildoers are planning to slaughter a cow on the bridge, this bridge here, or next to it. Let's see what we do about that. They don't do much these days, their hands are tied. They tend to monitor the situation. And the security companies, private security, who are very often the last barrier between decent folk and anarchy, are being maligned all over the country. There's marches against them. They're being called racist, which is absolute nonsense, because the vast majority of the security companies employ all kinds of people, all sorts. So there's no question of any bias. But they leave their jobs, and they have to. That's what they pay for. But they leave aligned, and the reason that has been done is so that the last vestiges of law and order can be swept aside.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Something I'd like to point out just before I read you a short story is in Haiti, which is the only country in the world, as far as I'm aware, that actually made a formal pact with Satan.
That's right. Yeah.
200-year pact. Their history was traumatic. They were populated mostly by slaves, and they revolted and they killed the overlords, almost the last man and woman and child. And then they drew up a sort of a constitution, and in it was a pact with Satan that they would worship Satan for the next 200 years as long as he protected them. And oddly enough, they didn't suffer too many major disasters in that 200-year period. But then the 200-year pact elapsed. And just a year or two later, they were hit by the biggest earthquake we've seen in that region for many, many years. So be careful who your friends are. The other thing about Haiti, and correct me if I'm wrong, but as far as I'm aware, that to be a voodoo priest in Haiti, you first have to be a Catholic priest. Your apprenticeship has to be served as a Catholic priest before you can become a voodoo priest. Check that out. That's what I read. Very interesting. Yeah. So, here we are. We are in the throes of a communist revolution. We're in phase two, in fact. You may well know that the communists have very long-term plans. They have 5-year, 25-year, and 50-year plans. And the West tends to have 5-year plans, kind of between presidents and campaigning. And anybody changes. But the communists have plotted a path, and the road to perdition, in fact, they are well on the road to perdition, which means spiritual ruin, of course. And they work in very long cycles. And you will notice in virtually all communist revolutions worldwide, phase one is to get into power. And whether they do that democratically, so-called, whether they outvote the locals, which is what happened here, or because they lost the war, there was a 30-year war against communism. And there's a lot of bad stuff that happened on both sides during that war. And the government forces of the day were not innocent. A lot of atrocities on both sides. It was a vicious and uncompromising war against a ruthless enemy. And a lot of people criticized it, and they felt justified in criticizing them by saying, oh, but they're fighting for apartheid. The natural fact that the servicemen, the guys on the ground with the helmets on and the rifles, like myself, like Pastor Hammond, we were certainly not fighting for apartheid. And in fact, right next to us, we would have black troops. We fought brothers in arms, and we fought white communism.
Yeah. So
not for apartheid, but against communism. And I might remind people, check my facts again. I don't believe the National Party, the Nationalist Party of that day, ever got more than 48% of the popular vote, if I'm not mistaken. So in other words, they were a single party with a single policy that had a support base, and they did what they called gerrymandering, which is you will take an area where you know you've got strong support, and you'll make three or four seats there. So they're into parliament. And you'll, an area where your support's not too good, one seat. Very easy to do. You control the municipalities, you just divide other SMPs. And the current regime, which is straightforward coming, and they might pretend they're not, but check out the cabinet. I mean, the majority of them are high ranking members of the Communist Party. They're using that old system and moving the little chips around to have the same result. And they win 60% normally. But remember, that means there's 40% to vote. Sometimes not for good reasons. They don't think they're radical enough, so they're paying for someone more radical. Or, anyway, that's all politics. But I am a historian, it's not my profession, I'm just an enthusiastic historian. And I bow my head to Pastor Hammond. He is a prolific author in history, and I've learned so much from him. And I love reading his stuff. It's straight to the point, and it's fiery, and I love it. So grab any of his books, you see at the back there, and you won't be disappointed. Especially the one sketches on South African history, and there's one in France now, Sketsa, which is a little encapsulation of our history. Each chapter is an era, you could say, or a great event, lovely reading, in a nutshell. So I'm trying to do a similar thing. This book was published 10 years ago in the United States, I might add, by an outfit called Sacred Truth, which is a Christian oriented outfit. They've been accused of being right wing or whatever, who cares. The reason I had to go to the United States to publish the first edition, this is in fact the second edition now. Was that no South African publishing company could touch it because it didn't toe the party line, because all publishing companies in this country are controlled. 10 years ago, social media was in its infancy, sort of a toddler. So we didn't have that spread where you've now got everybody having their say, regardless of mainstream media, they're just doing their thing, which is wonderful in many ways, very dangerous in others. But I had the first edition published in the United States, and it worked extremely well there, so we actually ended up doing a second printing in South Africa, so the second edition, and we improved the maps a bit and filled around. But it's essentially the same book. But I just want to read you a couple of pages, because a wise man once said that those who fail to learn the lessons of history are destined to repeat them. And we just see it again and again, cycle after cycle after cycle, because it only takes a generation or two to forget the lessons. We didn't feel the pain, we didn't see the bombs, we didn't hear the bullets, we didn't see the blood. We forget. We think, oh yeah, so they had a war, you know. Okay, it was over there, it didn't really affect us, yeah. And the most vicious, nasty of wars are civil wars.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because real wars are fought between armies, and a soldier could be safer in a sense. He's well armed, they're organized, they've got logistics, they've got armor, they've got backup. So That's why soldiers very often, people say, gee, you're brave, but he's armed. He knows who his enemy is. His enemy wears a uniform. He can't be identified. It's nothing personal. He's a soldier too. Might not like his ideology, but he's a soldier too. So show clemency if you have to, where you can. But other than that, your mission is to destroy your enemy. But in a civil war, your next door neighbor can be your enemy. The person who looks just like you can be your enemy. They're not wearing a uniform.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, this is where we're headed in this country. I'm sorry to say. God be with us, because if it descends into civil war, it's not going to be pretty. And the only way we can identify our enemy now is their ideology. If I look at this crowd we have here, we come in all sizes, colors, and shapes, yet we're all Christians, and we have the Holy Spirit. But I can look at a crowd that looks exactly like this one in another world, and they're raving Marxists. How do you tell the difference? So this is where social media comes in, and I know young folk are really up on it, and us older folk, the BCs as they call them, before Christ, before computers, we struggle along. I only found out 2 days ago what one of the buttons on my smartphone is. It's the on-off button. I've been using the kind of another one that makes it reload every time. I thought it was a little speaker or something, and I pressed it. My phone came on. I thought, gee, look at that. Fascinating. Anyway, but just joking. But we're getting the hang of it. But we struggle along. But you young folk, you have got that at your fingertips. Use it. It is a powerful weapon. You can influence people's perceptions, their beliefs, their outlook on life, their direction. You can do all of that by appealing to something. And you just sort of find that something. Their better nature, if they have one. Their ego, very often. Their fears, their hopes, their dreams, all the good stuff. Appeal to that. Draw them in. And draw them out. There's a lot of people on the internet and on social media. We've got an agenda, and it's not a good one. And draw them out. We do it all the time. This town, small as it is crawling with agents of all sorts. Good guys, bad guys, white hats, black hats, men in black, men in white, men with little earphone things, others who've got big tummies and big sponges. But they all have their eyes on this town. This is the microcosm of what's happening in this country. This town is the test case. The Marxists are saying it's immoral to have a holiday at home while there are people living in shacks. They're not saying invade the holiday home. But we know what they're saying. They are covetous, they are envious, and they want what people who worked really hard, what they have got, they want it, and they want it for free. And they're prepared to kill to do it. That's what we are up against. And we've got such good folk in this town who initially almost agreed with that sentiment. They said, oh, I suppose so. We own a town house in the country, we've got this holiday home. There are people living in shacks, that's not good. But the solution, obviously, is not to get a holiday home. The solution is to provide work, provide education. And that's why we live on an estate where almost a third of the houses are, in fact, what we call swallows. People who come from overseas, backwards and forwards, come for a few months a year, wealthy people. What do they bring? They buy a car, it stands in their garage, somebody makes the money. That's to be serviced. Our neighbors today say, oh, you follow in Scotch, it's usual. It's called the local auto electrician, money. They go to restaurants, the staff, earn money. They buy from the bakery, from the supermarkets. The shops do well. Salt earns money. They buy from the art galleries. They have garden services. Even when they're not there for 6 months, the garden service comes and buys money. Employment. That is the way. You know, we took 15 years to pay off the house. 15 years. We had to go and see them work because we couldn't get a job to work yet. But it's 15 years of salt to pay off a pretty modest time. You know, and now someone comes along and says, we're going to take your home because you're the wrong color, or you're the wrong breed, or whatever. You know, it's getting crazy. Anyway, let me read to you this one excerpt from Bulawa, and I'll tell you why it's called Bulawa very quickly. And there's one also young lady here, so she will be able to identify us with some of this. If you don't know this history, young lady, then your teacher slipped up, because they should have told you it. It's very important. But why it's called Bulawa, which as I say means slay, destroy, execute, kill, or a word. It's a Zulu word. And the first reference to it in the book is three, is when the Zulu king Ngam in 1838, he was visited by a delegation of Trekkers, who wanted to settle in Natal. They considered it the promised land, beautiful, green, and they saw themselves as sort of a lost tribe of Israel, in a way, in those days, the people of the book, they were. And they saw they'd been guided into this promised land and trekked 1,000 miles across harsh country, which was mostly empty in those days, if you check the history. They eventually ended up in the Natal, and there was a powerful Zulu king, Ngam. And they were told that the English settlers in Port Natal, which is now called Durban, had approached Shaka, he was the previous king, who had been gone, his half brother, murdered. They approached Shaka, the famous Zulu general, and asked him if they could live in Natal, which wasn't Zululand, of course, it was the other part of that area. And he said in Natal, the name of Portuguese, of course, Scorus, which means nativity, they were offshore for Christmas, named Natal, or Natalia. And Shaka had been murdered, and interestingly, Shaka had quite a regard, a high regard for these strange people who came from over the sea. And that's where the word Mulungu comes from. I've currently seen someone wearing a shirt, a white guy, saying, I'm a Mulungu. And I said to him, no offense, because you know this is slightly derogatory word. He says, no, it means white people. I said, no, it does. But it means white foam off the sea. So the foam that's left on the beaches as the wave comes, that's a Mulungu. So you can play with that word. But otherwise, that's sort of when it came up, because these people arrived. They were called swallows, strangely enough, by the Zulus. They kind of flew in on these strange craft with these kind of wings and these sails. So that word swallows is a very old one, too, describing people who perhaps this is not their home base, but they come. Anyway, that was many, many, many years ago. But either way, Dingon, a treacherous fellow, and so he murdered his brother to get power. And he allowed his words to approach him with what he regarded as a petition, which can we say on your land, or not your land, alongside good neighbors. And he sort of played along, and the boys, remember, were pretty Calvinistic Protestants, and many of them were French Huguenots, or as many would say Huguenots, or huge noses, as we used to say, it's called French huge noses. Anyway, they were pretty Calvinistic in a sense, and definitely Protestant, and they had fled, the Huguenots, in the late 1600s from Europe, because they were under political and religious persecution. The Edict of Nantes had been revoked, and they were under pressure again from the Catholics, and they fled. And they came to South Africa as guests of the Dutch, and they were allowed to settle in. And they were very educated people, very decent people, good families, about 200 families came out. And they settled in the frontier period, of course, French Corner. And to this day, you'll hear what we regard as South African surnames, Dutoit, of course, Dutoit, Duplessis. There's dozens of them. I mean, not a wrong surname, it's French surname. And interestingly, our people in this country, the Europeans who came and settled here, are virtually the same stock as settled in America. And in the book, I draw a lot of parallels between our history and American history. The Americans had their great trek west, so we had our great trek north and east. A lot of parallels. Cape Town was established a year before New York by the same people. The Dutch, it was New Amsterdam, came to New York. It was harvested. So there's a lot of parallels, a lot of correlations, and I'm trying to bring that in the book to keep the Americans interested, because we always want their attention. We always want their attention. Because we're a little American in a way. Our stock is Scandinavian, African, of course, back African, German, French, Swiss, Dutch, Flemish, Flams. In fact, Afrikaans is a lot closer to Flams, Flemish, than it is to Dutch. If you hear a Flemish person speaking, it sounds like a soft Afrikaans. If you hear a Dutch person speaking, you struggle to understand. So you really don't care. The way they speak is rather different. So it's closer to the Flemish. And so our stock here is very similar to what it is in America, the people who make up the population there. We don't have that many Hispanics, which the United States does. Not that many. But that's an odd thing, because the Portuguese were first to land, and they clashed with the locals, who were then called Barangos. By the way, they spoke which means settlers in Dutch. The Dutch gave them that name later. But the Khoi, of course, or Khoi, and the way they spoke the Fijian language sounded like their subject, so they called them Barangos. Now, with the Khoi or San, with San, of course, closer related to the original people who called Bushmen, who still call themselves that, very many of them. But they are reviving of their culture now, and I would encourage them. They need to rediscover their culture and reinvent it in some ways, because a lot of it was lost. The fine side of tales is all there, the legends are all there. They need to rebuild it. Very important right now, I think, that ethnic minorities in this country re-establish themselves as what they are within the greater framework. Anyway, so that was the first meeting between the Chippewas and the Zulu. And Shaka had quite a high regard for the first settlers that he met, because he was wounded in an assassination attempt, and a chap called Francis Burwell had some medical knowledge and he assisted him. And he was quite amazed at the Western medicine. So he and Shaka had quite a high regard, and he had no problem with that. But Lingon was a bit different, and he sold the Boer industries, because that's essentially what they were, about 70 of them, and they left to be women and children in the wagons some distance away and approached him. And he said, okay, but 2,000 of my best cattle, the pure white cattle, the royal cattle, were stolen by the Tlokwe. Chief Sekondiela, one of his rivals up towards the Kalan River. You recover those cattle for me, I'll sign your treaty, your petition, your land treaty. So off they went, and they managed to recover the cattle. They actually managed to arrest Chief Sekondiela and his bodyguards, and they took some guns off them and some horses. Now remember, there were no horses in Zaire. The Dutch put them in for more mobility, and they eventually got some stones, some of them ran away, I suppose, and they ended up what we call the Boer Pass. The Boer farm horse, tough horse, more like a pony actually, and the famous Basutu pony from Basutu, a mountain pony, is the descendant of those. There were no horses there. So they took 60 horses, it was 60, and some guns off these guys, and they let them go, Chief Sekondiela and his bodyguards. Took these cattle, horses and guns, and off they went back to the Zulu King. And they handed over the cattle. So the Zulu King said, well, what about the horses? They said, well, no, that wasn't part of the deal. And those horses were stolen from the Boers in the first place. And the guns probably too. And we had to disarm them, otherwise they would trouble us. And then they said, why don't you execute Chief Sekondiela? I said, well, we've got no scrap with him. No, we were just doing what it was to get your cattle back. No, no, you should have executed it, the king said. So, you know, he was looking for a reason, a raison d'etre, a reason for a causes fairly, a cause for conflict. And he sort of honed in on this that the horses, the Boers kept the horses and the guns, and that was a bit of a slave hand there, and he just wasn't too happy. Anyway, he said he'll sign it, as he had promised to. So the Boers stacked their guns outside the kraal, as they call it, which is a kraal, as they call it in America, enclosure, and the servants and assistants, colored people, guarded guns, and because the king said he doesn't want them coming in with guns, that's sort of intimidating. And he did it, so he went outside, and the inspector came in, he signed the deal, and he shouted out, Ulala, Ulala, Abba Zahrati, kill the wizards. They considered them wizards because they had a bit of technology and maps and various things, and they fell upon them, his body was, and they were dragged out of this cover of the enclosure, crawl, and brutally slaughtered. And immediately, Andy said, bring me the heart and liver of the leader. This will make us strong to meet our enemies, our future enemies. And then he sent out his enemies, his regiments, by their thousands. And they spread out across the country and they sought out the largest, the several wagons of the women and children, and the old men who had come on this this journey. And they attacked them, and it was the source of low grass, they called it Brutus, and on the Bushman's River, and that area is to this day they're all men in places we came. And they killed about 180 odd children, all the servants, who were most colored folk, and all the old men, many of the women, about 500 that they sort of brutally. And they picked the kids up by their feet and bashed heads against the wagon wheels, which was terrible. And the boys were shattered. Actually shattered, their children were killed. So those two had survived, others arrived, and eventually it was all the way to build. And they decided to take on this guy, this city. And I think you all know the story of the Battle of Red River. If you don't, look it up. It was a miraculous battle. The 500 of them trekked right into the land, provocatively, formed a wagon circle, waited to be attacked. They were attacked by between 12 and 20,000 of the best and bravest warriors in Africa, the city. And the battle raged all day. And at the end of the battle, 3,000 or 4,000 Zulus lay dead. Not one single boy. Not one. There's been no battle like it in the history of the world. And those who know their military history will agree. And the reason it went that way is because for 7 days before the battle, the boys fasted and prayed. And they formed a covenant with God. They said, we are covenant people. We ask you to give our enemy into our hand. And if we do, we will keep us as the Sabbath for our children. And we will build the church in honor that you get the glory for the victory. So it's like a Jericho moment, in a sense. But we're all friends now. We were. And in fact, there's a strange bond between the Boers and the Zulus. A strange bond because every year they meet at this battle site. The 180th anniversary was just a couple of weeks ago, the 16th of December, Day of the Covenant, as it's called. And an American writer, a very good book on it, called The Covenant, James Mitchell. But the 1,200 pages will take you 2 weeks to read. I managed to go through this in the story of the day before, so it goes a lot quicker. But it's a good book, which I was a brilliant writer. But his book ends about in the 80s, he died in the 80s, when Nelson Mandela was still a judge. So a lot of time has since then, so I managed to pick up that one on all of that. But either way, this was a phenomenal battle, and the Boers and Zulus to this day celebrate, not celebrate, commemorate the battle at Lodra, the site of the battle. And it's been changed from Ding Dong's Day, which was originally called, really wasn't his day, it was hosted. To the Day of the Covenant, or Shalom, as they call it in Afrikaans, the Great George Jesus, the Roman Lord, or whatever you want to do, all right. Shalom, and the Day of the Vow, it's now been changed to the Reconciliation. There you go. So that was the first Ulala. The second one was a British officer called Captain Alfred Ulala Taylor. He was an intelligence officer, and he was told by Lord Kitchener, General Lord Kitchener, in the Anglo-Boer War, the Second Anglo-Boer War, 1899-1902, when the British were taking a hammering. For the first 6 months of that war, they took an absolute hammering from what they called a rabble of farmers. Kept putting them down, but boy, with these guys sorted out. They were highly mobile, they were in commandos, that's where the word commando comes from. It's not a nice word. And they sorted the British out. And eventually, of course, the weight of arms, the mighty British Empire, half a million troops, 500,000 troops eventually fought on the side of Britain in this country against 50,000 Boers. So these are great bombs to tell, and they're usually crushed. But this captain of the law of Taylor is called Law of his nickname, because he's sure to shoot prisoners, black and colored workers, and take their cattle, and take their carriages and wagons there. And he went off to work with them in Rhodesia after the war as a very rich man. And guess what? The British Crown knighted him and gave him a big piece of land in Rhodesia for services to the realm. But of course, these were not written orders. He was told by Kitchener, fight fire with fire, take no prisoners. And the chaplain did take the falls of this chaplain called Breaker the Rat. Breaker of the Bronx and Peter Cullen. So he was tough out, but he was a breaker of horses, actually. And he came out to join the British forces as a volunteer, and he was responsible for the actual putting of the trigger on them. Occasions under the orders from Alfred Bullard Taylor. And he was eventually put up on trial by the British because the German Missionary Society complained or it's the intention of the British army that this guy was shooting prisoners, including a German missionary. He was also allowed on his way to report this guy to the British authorities and they took him out. So that was the second Bullard Taylor. He was put up in front of a firing squad, and he said something memorable just before he was executed. They asked him to invite a priest to pray with him before he was executed. And the chaplain was with him, who also was found guilty, Lieutenant Hancock, wasn't the right guy. He went along with Morant. Morant was a strong character. So Morant said, no thank you, I'm a pagan. Bang, down. And Lieutenant Hancock, he said, so am I, thank God. So that wasn't the best final loss of famous words, was it? By the way, he took the ball, and obviously made a movie of it called Breaking Arrangement. It's kind of a sympathetic portrayal, a good time to watch. By the way, the third reference to Bullard is what the really British in this country singing at their reference to the set. Bullard, killed the boys. They sing it openly. You would have had a chance to look at our visitors to the country, some of our local news. You'll see them singing openly, not just the ANC, but other parties, BLF, EFF, also Marxists. They sing it openly. Kill them, it's all racial, racial, racial. They're trying to stoke the race war. We're not going to do that. Anyway, just to finish off, this is interesting because, as I said at the beginning, history works in cycles. And if we don't learn the lessons, we just need to repeat them. So let's read it to you quickly. In the Eastern Cape, going back to the 1850s, in the Eastern Cape land of the courts, fighting often characterized relations between the various larger clans. The Tengu, from whose ranks grew up around Nelson Mandela, were at one stage threatened with war by the British after their chief executed a Lakota woman, which is a cause of clan. Anyway, it goes on. But as I said, they were soon faced with an unexpected phenomenon in the form of a young girl who would be partly responsible for the devastation of their land and people, and who would destroy them as a military force and even threaten their very existence. She's a proper test. And her name probably said was Nongkwa Unse, but the white folk couldn't say it, so they called it Nongkwa Unse. And she was only 14 years old when she managed to convince the people to commit what amounted to national suicide. In 1856, the royal pain of an uncharismatic young girl was sitting, staring into a pool of water alongside the Tara River, when she allegedly saw a vision of her Lakota ancestors, the Xhosa clan. They told her in the vision that they were prepared to return and drive the hated settlers back into the sea from whence they had come. But first, as an act of supreme faith and the ability to achieve this, the Xhosa would have to kill all their own cattle and consume all their own crops. Those tribesmen who refused would be magically transformed into frogs, mice, and even ants. And then blown into the sea themselves by a powerful whirlwind conjured up by their ancestors. Number quality told him about the village Sangoma, which is a bushwalker, about the vision, and he, duly impressed, approached the tribal chiefs of her Mutoka. There she repeated what she'd seen in her vision, and her uncle had his own notion that the Russians, whose army had presumably had recently engaged England in the Crimean War, one of the Crimean Wars in the 1850s, would arrive timely to assist the daughter in driving out the settlers, the white settlers. Of course, due to his scant knowledge of the world outside the Eastern Cape, one of his uncle probably didn't realize that the Russians at that stage were themselves white men. Delighted at the prospect of bringing the land to the whites, the daughter enthusiastically set about slaughtering their own herds, killing an estimated 200,000 cattle. 200,000. Great feasts were held, and for the rest of that year, they partied as if there was no tomorrow. They soon consumed all their own crops, winter arrived, and they continued feasting on their cattle. Spring arrived, and they did not bother to plant any crops, convinced that they would never have to work again. Once they inherited the fat herds and grain stores of the whites, whom they believed would be driven back to the sea whence they had come, or rules. Summer came, and the fate of their destiny, February 18, 1857, finally dawned. Their teenage seer, prophetess, had confidently predicted that a blood red sun would rise that day and would stand still above the sea, and then change course and immediately set again in the east, from whence it had risen, and the hated settlers would flounder and drown in the waves, leaving all their wealth to the foreigner. As the sun rose on that fateful day, and people sat waiting expectantly, the sun continued along its normal course through the summer sky high above them, and finally set in the west, as it ever had since creation. Darkness fell on the ruined cause of trial. Salvation soon sought the land, and the sight of spiritual tribesmen and their families flooding into the settled towns early for food became commonplace, and the theft of cattle and crops became more frequent. Despite the best efforts of the kind hearted settlers in feeding the sovereign quarter from their own rapidly depleting stores, the self-induced famine claimed the lives of 55,000 Xhosa, about half of the entire tribe at that time. This became known as the Great Delusion, the Great Cattle Killing Delusion. Nkosi, who was understandably unpopular by that stage, fled to King Williamstown for refuge in the British tribe was arrested and shipped her off to Robben Island for her own safety, because the people were not too happy with it. She could not have known that a little over a century later, one of her own tribesmen, Nelson Rockefeller Mandela, whose middle name, colloquially, incidentally, means he who shakes the tree. In other words, sort of troublemaker in a sense, that's the name they gave his child. We were also incarcerated. This is one of our own grandson. On that very same bleak, rocky outcrop in the sea overlooked by Table Mountain. Nelson Mandela would be imprisoned for attempting to start a race war. A lot of people will argue with that point, but I'm happy to debate with them. That would also be supporters of a tribe of whites back into the sea, leaving to the blacks all their wealth, homes, and farms free for the taking. He too, although ultimately more successful in his endeavors, would be in a remarkable twist of fate also to look to Russia for assistance, because remember that in the freedom struggle, and there were some good aspects of it, there's no question, there were a lot of very bad things that the nation's government was doing, and very bad laws which they put in place, humiliating laws, which universally changed. But the support that the freedom fighters got was largely enormous. A lot from the West as well, but that was because they said democracy, democracy, the West loves democracy. So they supported them, they didn't say we're also communists. So the Russia and China essentially supplied most of the arms. The conclusion is these are the recurring themes and cycles of life and death and history on the African continent, which is not just on the African continent, worldwide. The cause of the tribe, though devastated by the self-induced famine, would rise again, and ultimately one of their own sons, a royal of the Tengu clan, would become the first black president of a future and new South Africa. And of course, Nelson Mandela was a man of his time. He was an exceptional man, and he was a reconciliatory man, and he came out of prison uninvested, and that's why his appeal was so strong. as people approach him, you know, this guy's been sitting in jail for 25 years or more, and he's come out and he's not full of vitriol and hate. He loves his country, he loves his people of all kinds, and he wants them to come together. And you've got to hear that. Others will say, yes, he said that the struggle continues, and between his release and the election, something like 20,000 people were killed in their lives. So they say, no, we can delay this until the cows come out. But he was a man of his time, and he left us some good things. Pastor Hammer met him. I would leave it to Pastor Hammer to describe his meeting, if he ever gets a chance. With Nelson Mandela and the questions about our person in the intent, but I didn't meet this little king, who was also a teen who saw him. He was a young man when I met him with his first wife. And he could speak very English at the time with his wife, and we had a good chat. Now, my brother in Zulu is back in English. So, we've had some amazing people rise up in this country, some of us will go out and so on. But at the end of the day, we were also Africans. And we have to pull together, we have to hold it together. We cannot allow this country to collapse into a Marxist hellhole. And right now, the lesson of history about covetousness, jealousy, envy, wanting to take what's not yours, you know, our short one covet is not a suggestion, it's a commandment. And these Marxists play on people's fears and hopes. And if you put about this person sitting in the shade, you have no skills, you have nothing to offer the job market, you really don't have much of the future, and a guy comes along and says, support my party, the radical Marxists, and we will make you rich, and ourselves, of course. But why wouldn't you vote for them? So the message has to go out that hard work never hurts anyone. And given opportunities, I have seen the most humble people with the poorest education rise to great heights and achieve great things. And guess what? Most of them are Christians. So I say, pray for our country, please. And don't forget that little verse that the line that keeps getting left out of that if my people humble themselves and pray for the little of the land, there's a line of G there, turning from their wicked ways. And we have to point out the wickedness of this onslaught that we're facing, this Marxist onslaught. And thank you for listening. It's been a pleasure for Master, and thank you, Dr. Hammer. We grow every day in our knowledge, and we've learned a lot from each other. Certainly, I've learned a lot from Peter. And Peter, please find for me that fiery sermon where a preacher, an army chaplain, is addressing the communist enemy, and he said to them, I'm paraphrasing, you should be crawling through your minefields to get to the service, to kneel at the feet of the Son of God and beg forgiveness before you meet your God, Karl Marx, in hell. And Peter knows, I think, that sermon, and I'm hoping you'll find it in the cemetery somewhere. But I'd love to be able to keep saying it. Thank you very much.